Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. What are you laughing at?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Take two.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
What, did something funny happen?
No, that's okay. Just go ahead.
Yeah.
I guess everybody knows
who this is.
All right, I'm sorry. I'll try and collect myself.
Okay. This is Georgianne Hughes and Joseph Farrell.
Okay.
Joseph has a PayPal button on his side. Please use it.
Well, thanks. Help out Georgianne too.
What?
I said help out Georgianne too.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Spanky needs pork neck bones.
Oh, jeez. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, they're cheap bones.
My. Okay, I'm better now.
Okay. We're going to talk about Financial Vipers of Venice.
If we can. I'm sorry.
Alchemy, money, magical physics, and banking in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. And Joseph, a lot of this garbage seems to be happening all over again.
Oh boy, isn't it the truth? Yeah, you know, I had planned to write that book originally, as you know, as part of the banking I wanted to do, and while I was writing it, I thought, my word, I might as well be writing this about today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, everything about Venice is... It's like we're looking at a Renaissance mirror of what the United States has become.
Yep.
You know, because outwardly Venice is a republic.
Mm-hmm.
It has its legislature, it has its executive, it has its judiciary, and it's all in this lovely, supposedly lovely system of checks and balances. And behind the scenes, you have essentially a few families that are all part of the Venetian oligarchy. They're part of the Venetian nobility.
Yeah.
And they, if you know, I put a list of the doges of Venice.
Yes, that's quite a list.
It's quite a list, and it's revealing because you keep seeing the same family names over
and over again.
And over. It's a revolving door.
Yeah.
And, you know, you only have to look at, in a certain sense, the people going in and out of the U.S. federal government since the turn of the last century. And seeing the same families, seeing the same connections, seeing the same corporations represented over and over and over. So there's that. But there's also, in Venice, you have the development, really, of the modern financial system, in that Venice develops double entry accounting.
Yeah.
Venice develops insurance. It develops deposit banking, which, you know, and that's a very important point that people have to understand. Venice was not really renowned for its international merchant bankers as much as it was renowned for its deposit bankers. Now, lest people misunderstand what I'm saying here, the merchant bankers of that era were actually located in Florence, and I talk a bit about them in the book as well, as you know. But those companies in Florence that were conducting international trade, they were basically international commodities brokers.
Yeah.
And they made loans to governments in return for government concessions for their particular corporation. So in other words, they practiced classic mercantilism that we see going on in this country today. And if you want to know what mercantilism is, the current term for it is crony capitalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like to call it crony capitalism. But,
be my guest.
Sure. glad to help.
Yeah.
But anyway, Venice, on the other hand, if you look at the bankers on the Rialto, they developed deposit banking. And within the city of Venice itself, you conducted most of your daily business and trade through these bankers that would simply pay off your bills by transferring numbers on a ledger.
Yeah.
And, you know, that may seem like no big deal because we're so used to it today, but back then it was a huge deal because what it meant was that commerce within the city of Venice itself no longer required the counting out or weighing of coins.
Yeah.
So it basically drastically increased the money supply in the Venetian Republic. It freed up all that coin for international trade.
Oh.
So, you know, Venice, at a stroke of a pen, literally, the way that they did their banking, they created a huge money supply, which, of course, was the basis of their power. And then finally, Venice is unique in its hidden institutions, and we have to take some time to understand those. One of the most interesting parallels between the Venetian Republic and the modern United States was this entity or institution in Venice called the Council of Ten.
Oh, boy.
And to this day, if you go to Venice and go to the Doge's Palace in Venice, you'll see around the exterior of the palace these lion's heads with open mouths.
Yeah.
And in Italian, above them, is the phrase per segrete denunciato, for secret denunciation. So literally anybody in Venice could denounce someone else for some malfeasance, real or imagined.
Yeah, just like very much like what can go on here now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you'd be picked up off the street by the Venetian intelligence services and hauled into the Council of Ten and tortured and so on and so forth. Now, the Council of Ten, just to let people know what it is the council that controls all Venetian intelligence. Now, to understand what that means, you have to understand that Venice, as the commercial trading empire of the West at that time, had its intelligence agents literally spanning the then-known world all the way from England to China.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, these intelligence agents would, in turn, plus, you know, Venetian shipping and so on and so forth, provided another source of intelligence. Because of this, Venice could, pardon me, could easily understand coming market trends.
Mm-hmm.
And this is particularly important when we get to the subject of how it manipulated bullion, all right? But the Council of Ten is in charge of this far-flung intelligence empire. On top of this, the Council of Ten has summary powers to pull anybody off the street.
Kind of like the NSA.
It is the Venetian equivalent of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah.
Because they have summary powers of interrogation, summary police powers. They report only to the Doges of Venice, and they can actually try somebody outside of the normal legal channels in Venice, pass death sentences, which are not appealable.
Yeah.
And usually if that happened to you, you were executed immediately. I mean,
oh,
there was just no waiting around. That was it. And just to make drive the point home, after that happened, they'd hang you upside down by your legs in the poles around the main square in Venice, so everybody can look at you, you know, and send a message. So in other words, the Council of Ten basically rules Venice for the financial oligarchy that actually runs the city.
Do we know their names?
The financial oligarchs?
No, the Council of Ten.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
The Council of Ten is basically using state-sponsored terror to rule. Okay. Now, as far as the people who are members of the Council of Ten, to hold any office whatsoever in Venice, be it on the Grand Council or be it the Doges or, you know, the head of the grain office or, you know, a member of the Council of Ten, you had to be a member of their nobility.
Yeah.
In other words, you had to be one of the either long historical families that migrated northward from Rome into the Lagoon when the Huns were marching through Italy, or you had to be an admitted member of the newer nobility that was granted noble status by dint of your wealth or power or whatever.
Yeah, you buy your way in.
You buy your way in.
Yeah.
Now, in other words, the resemblance to Venetian society and the modern American culture, or political culture, I should say, is very palpable and real, because to hold political office at the federal level in this country, you've become basically a satrap of the corporations and of the banks. You don't hold office unless you represent that class. So in other words, Venice has the outward trappings of a republic, but really, in reality, it's a plutocracy, it's an oligarchy, and it's ruled by a certain narrow set of people who have set the whole thing up to make sure they stay in power and that no one else is admitted to power without their approval. So,
Well, Joseph, it's not so different from today.
No.
You know, Guantanamo, a lot of those men that were picked up had to go through rendition, it was done so by bounty.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like my neighbor, so I'll turn them in.
Yeah.
You know,
Exactly. And this is the other thing. I mean, it reached the corruption in Venice reached the point, Georgianne, that at one period of its history, you actually had the government of Venice openly advertising or soliciting loans from the bankers on the Rialto to raise money to assassinate the King of Hungary.
It would be
akin to taking out an advertisement in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal. You know, the United States government needs money, you know, this amount of money, so that we can assassinate the leader of this particular country. I mean, it's, you just have to kind of shake your head that it was so corrupt and so brazenly corrupt. You know, I never cease to be amazed at the parallels that exist between the Venetian Republic and what the United States has become now. And the other parallel, there's another parallel that we have to mention. And to kind of set this up, let me use an example.
Okay.
The Venetians were renowned for their Byzantine intrigues and their double dealing. Well, we all know the story of the Fourth Crusade. The Pope decides that, you know, he wants a crusade to go over there and knock some Muslim heads together and retake the Holy Land, okay? Mm-hmm. And so he calls for the Fourth Crusade, and the French, you know, being the French, they sign up and join up right away. You know, good idea, let's go knock some Muslim heads together.
Oh, dear.
But no one has the money, of course. So you can see where this is going. No one has the money and no one has the ships, but guess who? So, and the other problem at the time is that Venice has some recalcitrant and troublesome provinces of its emerging empire on the Dalmatian coast in what would be modern-day Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
So you've just got to get a picture of this. Venice has the ships. Venice has the money. The French, of course, come to Venice solicitous for loans and ships to raise their army. And of course, Venice is only too pleased to do this. And it's really interesting. At the time, the Doge of Venice is a 90-plus-year-old man that's gone down. Enrico Dandolo is his name, and he's gone down in history as the blind Doge of Venice, okay?
Yeah.
But the trouble is, we don't really know if he was blind or not.
Oh, dear.
So in other words, the possibility arises that you have this guy pretending to be blind. But gosh, he may not really be, but everybody thinks he's blind, and this is an important part of the story.
Oh, gosh.
So, of course, finally the Fourth Crusade is raised, and they get the ships, they assemble an army, and Dandolo decides, well, I'll just lead this thing myself.
Yeah.
So off they go in the Venetian ships, and on the way, he says, oh, by the way, we need to stop here at the city of Zara and lay siege to it.
Oh, dear.
Because they, you know, they're rebellious and all of this stuff. So they do. And, of course, the Pope at the time, which is Innocent III, which is another...
Oh, he's
part,
a...
Oh, yeah, I know.
Innocent III, what a name.
Well, it's like Pope's named Pius. You know?
Yeah.
Or Clement.
Yeah.
They're anything but at the time. But anyway... So the Venetians lay siege to Zara, and of course the Pope excommunicates them for attacking a fellow Christian city, and of course the Venetian bishops that are along with the crusading armies conveniently mislay the letter of excommunication.
Oh,
and while they're there, and this is where it gets really interesting, Georgianne, while they're there, an emissary comes from Germany representing an exiled Byzantine prince,
yeah,
who is the rightful heir to the throne in Constantinople.
Oh.
And he comes with a proposal that, hey, you know, it's getting kind of late here. It's kind of too late to go attacking the Muslims in the Middle East. Let's go to Constantinople. You help me regain my throne.
Uh-huh.
And I'll increase your privileges, okay? So off they go to Constantinople, Enrico Dandolo, the blind Doge, leading all the way.
Okay.
And they of course, lay siege to Constantinople. They are victorious over the Byzantine emperor, and they depose the ruling family. They install a Venetian puppet and gain even more concessions in Constantinople. And, of course, all of this just infuriates Pope Innocent III even more because he's wanting to try and patch things up with the Greek church. And, of course, the Greeks are now mad because these evil Westerners have installed.
Oh,
you know, it just goes on and on, okay?
Oh.
Now, let's back the thing up here. Because I'm using this as an example of Venetian Byzantine duplicity, all right?
Okay.
Before the Crusade even set sail and ended up not in the Middle East but in Byzantium, before it even set sail, the Venetians had minted an almost identical replica to the East Roman hypeperon, which was a coin that was kind of the reserve currency of the day that was minted by the Byzantine Empire.
Oh, my.
So, in other words, the Venetian intent, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and this puts me at odds with academic historians, is revealed from the outset because they were intending to drive out the Byzantine coinage as the coin of trade in Eastern Mediterranean trade.
Okay.
And the other thing you have to remember is, again, the Venetians had a far-flung intelligence service. They would have known about this exiled Byzantine prince and his aspirations to regain the throne. And this is the way they operated, Georgianne. And to, as a final convincing element here, as the French were negotiating with Dandolo prior to the departure of the crusade for the East, and even really before the ink was dry on the contract for all of this, prior to this, the Venetians, of course, were saying, yeah, we'll transport your army to the Middle East. But at the same time, they're negotiating with the Sultan in Egypt, promising, no, we won't attack you.
Yeah.
Okay. So in other words, the target, as far as Venice was concerned, and as far as the evidence really indicates all along, was Constantinople.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at what happened in Constantinople, what do you find? Well, the good old blind Doja is personally leading the attack.
Oh, brother. Oh, my gosh.
It defies any military imagination how someone blind can be leading a fleet of galleys and catapults and siege engines and everything else. You know.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really have, when you look at the history of Venice the Middle Ages, you really have to train yourself to read between the lines of these wonderful academic histories. Because what you're reading in these academic histories is kind of a medieval version of the Warren Report.
Yeah.
but the conspiratorial reality is something far different. But, you know, Venice, I said all of that kind of preparatory as an example because Venice was known for this kind of double dealing.
Yeah.
And the parallel that Venice has with the modern-day United States...
are many.
Are many, and particularly in this respect. Because Venice betrayed its own kind of cultural allies on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
It used its military and economic power in such a way as to gain ever more concessions from... you know, just about everybody,
yeah,
to increase its own wealth and power. And at a certain point in European history, Georgianne, it managed to literally piss off so many people.
Yeah, I can see why. Yeah.
That everybody else just finally had it and said, you know, we're going to take this troublesome little entity out once and for... imagine a city... is basically ruling the Eastern Mediterranean and controlling all the international commerce in Western Europe. So in other words, everybody just had at one point finally had it, and they decided to band together and go to war and take out Venice. And this really became the first real, genuine European continental war.
Yeah.
It's called the War of the League of Cambrai.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I put the preamble of the treaty that announced the league or the alliance of the countries that were going to go fight Venice. And I did so for a reason, because you have to read this thing in order to see just how pissed off people really were.
Well, people in the world are getting
exactly
at this country
exactly
now.
For the same sort of behavior and reason.
Yes.
That's my point.
Double dealing,
lying, cheating, financial manipulation,
yeah,
that ends up stealing the livelihood of the middle class, not only of your own country, but several others.
Yes.
You know, the extension of a financial system that's based on oligarchy and corruption, and on we could go. So that, you know, Venice has several lessons for us, and that's one of them. The other lesson that Venice has is that it controlled, and I hope people that are what I call metalists are listening very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not against, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not against the idea that money should represent value rather than debt. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with gold standards or silver standards or any other sort of commodity value-backed money.
Right? Yeah.
My problem is the people that think that a bullion standard of some sort is much more stable and not subject to manipulation.
Oh, boy. They've got another thing coming.
They've got another thing coming.
Yeah.
You know, you only have to read the history of this country, for one thing. But when you start delving into what Venice did in terms of manipulation, that story goes all the way back to Babylon's banksters. And let's recall what I said there. In ancient times, you saw the rise of an international bullion brokering class because the Far East valued silver more than it did gold. And the West valued gold more than it did silver. Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
You got to wonder, how did that come about? But when you look at that, you can just see immediately the possibilities for manipulation and the enrichment of a class of people that do nothing but trade in bullion. And this is, you know, you're manipulating the gold to silver exchange rate. That's basically what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at what Venice does, since it's basically controlling the bullion market in Western Europe at that time, it has intimate firsthand knowledge of the ratio, the price value of gold to silver at any given moment.
Yeah.
And if you're a company that is loaning money to governments and that money has to be repaid in gold, what happens if the rate of exchange of gold to silver goes down when they repay you?
Yeah.
Well, this is exactly what happened to the Florentine companies, and they crashed precisely because, if you study the record very closely and carefully, which I recount in the book, it's because at that time in history, Venice was importing gold into Europe madly.
Oh, boy.
So, in other words, they were collapsing the gold-to-silver exchange rate, and all these Florentine companies that had loaned money when gold was relatively more scarce were being paid back in gold that was now much more plentiful.
Yeah.
And therefore, they were being paid back with inflated money.
Oh, boy.
To see what happened. They were caught in a bullion vice, quite literally, that was of Venetian coinage, not to coin a pun. So, you know, there's lots to this story.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, it just goes on and on and on. The other thing that we have to kind of prep people for, and I know I'm just chattering away endlessly without reaching a period, but the other thing we have to kind of watch, and I was very careful to mention this in the book, although I didn't explore it very deeply. But you know me, I like to plant the little seeds that are going to blossom much later in the story.
Yeah.
Well, the other part of the story that we have to watch is that the Venetian nobility, as Venice expanded into northern Italy, it then, of course, recruited the noble houses of the cities that it conquered.
Yeah.
And these houses in turn, this is such a crucial part of the story, these houses in turn have their own connections north of the Alps in Germany.
Uh-huh.
We have to understand that Venice was an autonomous province both within the Eastern Roman Empire and within the Holy Roman Empire, which, of course, comprised most of modern-day Germany and, at that time in history, northern Italy.
Yeah.
So you have these connections of the Venetian nobility north into Germany and the German noble houses. This is a key component of the story. The other key component is that the Venetians teach some of the very famous early German banking families their accounting practices and other practices, like the Fuggers family in Germany.
Yeah.
You know, they were so famous, they attracted the ire and attention of Martin Luther.
So, oh, boy.
You know. Now, there's one final thing that we have to mention here, and this is another one of those examples of Venetian duplicity, and I hope people can understand what they're seeing being written in Venice is the modern international banker's playbook.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what they're really seeing. So there's another thing we have to pay attention to, because, of course, in the Renaissance, what's going on? You've got the Protestant Reformation going on, and you've got the Catholic Counter-Reformation going on.
Yeah.
And Europe is dividing itself into two religious camps.
Uh-huh.
All right? I should say Western Europe is dividing itself. And lo and behold, we have in Venice a fellow by the name of Gasparo Cardinal Contarini, okay? A Roman Catholic cardinal from Venice. With me?
Yes.
And who is he really enamored of? Whose theology does he really like? Well, Martin Luther.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, he even writes a few letters to him. And if you read Cardinal Contarini himself in his theological opinions, he's got a position very close to Martin Luther.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But on the other hand, Cardinal Contarini just so happens to be the very cardinal that the Pope put in charge of preparing the Reform Council,
yeah,
for the Catholic Church that ends up being the Council of Trent.
Oh, my goodness.
And on top of that, Cardinal Contarini is the personal sponsor who brings to the Pope's attention an obscure little Spanish outfit or order that he wants to promote as kind of the papal soldiers, and that, of course, is the Society of Jesus.
Yeah.
The Jesuits.
Yeah.
So look what we have. We have a Venetian cardinal who likes Lutheran theology.
Yeah.
Who stays in correspondence with same. And on the other hand, he's preparing the Council of Trent that is going to denounce all of these Protestant heretics, and he's sponsoring the rise of the Jesuits. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So, now, you know, that's just one Venetian. There's another one that I didn't even talk about in Financial Vipers of Venice, but rest assured he's going to play a role in the next book.
Oh, boy.
And his name is Paolo Sarpi. All right, mm-hmm. And again, this guy is a priest. He's obviously, you know, a Roman Catholic priest, and he's a famous canonist, a canon lawyer. And who is he giving advice to?
Mm.
Try Henry VIII.
Oh, brother.
Now, you know, I could go on and on, Georgianne, but the point is that at this stage, Venice becomes one of the major publishing houses of Europe, of course, because
yeah.
What's the information revolution at that time? Well, it's the printing press.
Yeah.
And the oligarchs realize that, you know, we've got a real problem on our hands here. We'd better gain control of it. So they establish Venice as the major publishing center in Europe at this time. And what are they publishing? Well, they're publishing both Protestant and Catholic works of theology.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
Church history and everything else. So
yeah.
In other words, they've got their finger into every pie possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to agree with Webster Tarpley, because the way it looks to him is that what the Venetians are doing is they are deliberately exacerbating the religious conflict of the day,
yeah,
as a means of disguising their transference of their wealth and power northward.
Oh.
In other words, they know the handwriting is on the wall. You can't have a global empire or attempt to rule one from a swamp at the north end of the Adriatic Sea.
No fooling.
Okay.
That's true.
Times, they are a-changing, you know.
Yeah.
Christopher Columbus has gone and found the New World. Dang it, you know, and that kind of puts a crimp in our trade.
Oh, geez.
So, So if we're going to have world domination, we can't do it from this place anymore.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I'm putting it very bluntly, but that's what I think happens. And that's why I spent the time in the book pointing out that, you know, you have to look at the Venetian nobility's ties to these noble houses north of the Alps, because this is going to become the way that they transfer their concepts, their ideas of organizing the economy and of organizing the state northward.
Mm-hmm.
So where do they go? Well, what other city in Europe most resembles Venice that's in a swamp and you get around by traveling on boats and canals?
Up in the north.
Yeah.
Far north. Amsterdam, yeah.
Yep, Amsterdam. So in other words, you have the Venetian virus is transferred, at least conceptually, northward. And you from there, of course, it hops over the channel and into London. So in other words, this is an important story.
And well, Joseph, were the original Venetians known as the Black Nobility?
Well, I hear a lot of that on the internet, and see a lot of it. And this is the other reason I wrote the book, because you have claims that the Venetians deliberately engineered the Black Plague, that they deliberately engineered the collapse of the Florentine super companies, which I think they did.
Yeah.
And most of the book is about what they did and how they did that. All right,
it's quite an indictment.
It is. But the problem is, you know, when it comes to things like the Black Plague and the move northward, the people that are saying these things and promoting those ideas are not, as usual, giving you the details and giving you the footnotes.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's my problem with so much research in this alternative community. Give us something more than opinion. Argue your case better. And that's what I attempted to do.
Well, you did very well.
Well, thank you. But my point is, you know, with the Florentine super companies, what you have to do is you have to sit down and read the academic sources and then connect the dots between them.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to come right out and tell you any of this.
Yeah.
The other thing you need to do is, and this is why I spent time with two particular families that are mentioned very briefly in Financial Vipers, but I mention them briefly because they're the means of connecting the dots in this transference of Venetian wealth and power northward, and proving that there is not just a continuity of conception in that transference, but a continuity of personal links.
Yeah.
Okay? In other words, once you start talking about personal links, then you are talking about real honest-to-goodness conspiracy.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's the key here. The family that I mentioned, and people can, you know, once I tell them here in this interview, people can go online and Google it and see immediately what the connections are from this one family that has clear ties to the Venetian nobility. So what I'm giving you, Georgianne, is not a direct answer to your question about internet conspiracy theories involving Black nobility. I'm giving you a real detail here that you can go out and you can look at the connections.
Mm-hmm.
All right? The family name is D'Este.
Is what?
D'Este. D'Este. Little D, apostrophe, E-S-T-E.
Okay.
D'Este. All right? If you look at this noble family, you're going to discover that it's linked to the House of Bavaria.
Oh, boy.
Right? It's linked to the House of, here it comes, Hanover.
Oh, brother.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can we all say George the Third here?
Yeah.
All right. And in its Germanicized form, in the Germanic or German version of the family name, it's the House of Welf, W-E-L-F.
Huh.
And, of course, that's where you get the Italian version, Guelph. Remember, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines from the Middle Ages, for all my medieval history students out there. All right. in Germany, they were known as the Welfs and the Weiblings, all right? And the party lines there, the divisions, which often split right through the same family, were between those who supported the papacy's claims to supreme power and those who supported the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Now, the Welfs, if you look at the family of Welf Este, which, you know, the lines reunite at a certain period, you're going to end up with a very famous British monarch, okay?
Oh, boy.
Who had lots of children, and they married lots of other royal families all over Europe.
Okay? Oh, brother.
Are we getting the picture of who she was? Okay.
Oh.
So, in other words, You don't have to look long and far to find the family connection back to Venice and to Venetian practices. You don't have to look very far at all. But the problem is, you know, few people are telling you these things or pointing out, well, look here at this family, look there at that family. Another connection to look at is, you know, the very famous, powerful German noble family of von Thurn-Taxis. I'm sure you've heard of that family.
Yeah.
Well, the Italian version of that family name is Della Torre e Tassos, all right? So in other words, you've got a noble family with an Italian branch and a German branch because of the connections way back to the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And again, there are definite Venetian connections there. Now, the interesting thing I point out in the book, and I kind of pick up from Babylon's Banksters. You'll recall that in Babylon's Banksters, an American professor by the name of Tenney Frank did a study of what had happened to the late Roman Republic and the early Roman Empire, because he noticed that the people's graves, the markings on their graves, were no longer Latin names. They were Greek.
Oh my goodness.
And even in their Greek forms, they were names that were really of people increasingly, the later in history it got, they were increasingly from Chaldea.
Mm-hmm.
All right, in other words, from Mesopotamia.
Oh my goodness.
And he noticed that even Juvenal, you know, the Roman satirist, complained of the Orontes, in other words, the Euphrates, flowing into the Tiber.
Yes.
And that was his metaphor for the Babylonian influence that had taken over Imperial Rome.
Yeah.
And these families, this is an important part of the story, they were brought to Rome as slaves. And in the Roman practice, very often, you know, if you were a slave, when your master died, you were freed.
Yeah.
And in the Roman practice, very often, not always, but oftentimes you were educated as a slave because you educated the master's children and so on and so forth. So you learned Roman law and you learned Roman administration.
Well, Joseph, the same thing today. People are educated to be factory workers,
right,
or whatever, you know, salesmen.
But my point here is that when the Huns overrun the Western Roman Empire, these Chaldean families flee northward, and many of them end up in the lagoon at Venice, founding the city-state there. So there is a loose connection, very, very loose connection, then, between the Venetian state and its concepts and, ultimately, Babylon.
Yeah.
And that's another important part of the story. So, you know, it's what I'm doing is I'm trying to connect dots for people and show that you're dealing with something very old.
Oh, yeah. Well, Hammurabi declared, I think, 4 or 5 jubilees because of debt.
Well, yes, and you know that was common practice, and I talk about that in Financial Vipers of Venice. There's a primordial debt theory that is attached both to religion and to finance.
Yeah.
And you know we've talked about this before when Dr. DeHart and I were kind of collaborating on Grid of the Gods, the reason I wanted him as being kind of a contributor to that book and listed him that way is because the seventh chapter in that, where we're talking about Aztec concepts of sacrifice and then Western Christian concepts of the sacrifice of Christ, are based on old conversations that he and I had. And the important point there that we were trying to make is that the conceptual logic is the same in both cases. Sacrifice as a system doesn't arise in any other context other than the idea of a debt that is owed to the gods.
You know, by the way, Graham Hancock has out a book where he talks about the Aztec sacrifices.
Uh-huh.
And he said in one instance, I forget who the so-called Aztec god was, but they sacrificed literally 80,000+
yes.
people in 4 days.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, my God.
In fact, I think I talk about the same thing. I think I mentioned the same text that he's referring to in Grid of the Gods. That,
oh, wow.
You know, that is an actual Aztec record or text that was kept to that. You know, it was just barbaric.
Yeah.
But the conceptual logic that underlies it is the same. In that you have the idea that, you know, the metaphor that I talk about in so many of my books, in some cases begins to be interpreted in kind of poetic language as a debt owed to the gods
yeah.
in life. Well, you know, we use this language of debt in our language of love all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm forever in your debt.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't mean the language of love in that case literally.
Yeah.
We mean it as an expression of endearment.
Yes.
But at a certain point in history, that language, I think, gave rise to understanding that cosmological metaphor in the literal sense, in the literal way.
Uh-huh.
That we come into this world owing a literal debt that we cannot repay.
Well,
and therefore you attempt to placate the wrath of God or whatever through the act of sacrifice.
Well, you wrote in your book, I want to know exactly what you mean, indebtedness to the creation
mm-hmm.
and the sacrifice and dismemberment. What does that literally mean?
Well, the first expressions of sacrifice as an understanding of the metaphor that I write about in so many books, and
yeah.
again in this book, because it has direct implications for finance.
Yeah.
That's the way it began to be understood in the late Renaissance. But if you go back, if you turn back the clock and go back to India and to the Vedic tradition,
yeah.
obviously they understand or they had a way of expressing this metaphor as well, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Vishnu, Brahma, and Krishna, you know, that's their trinity.
Yeah.
And when you look at the expression of the metaphor in that context, in the Indian context, what they are saying is that the diversity of the world that results from that initial differentiation in the nothing that
yeah.
everything comes from is a kind of dismemberment.
Oh.
Okay? It's a fracturing of the whole. That's one of the metaphors. This is the problem with metaphors. Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I choose to use mathematical terms to describe it, because you avoid the traps of ordinary language and what can result from using
right.
it. Well, when you start to say dismemberment, and sacrifice, then you start to understand, okay, if this is literally true of the physical medium, then the way you gain power over it is by an act that is in harmony with that original dismemberment or sacrifice. So you actually start to perform the sacrifice in order to put yourself in direct touch with it, in order to manipulate it. Hmm. And that's where it comes from. And as I've been at great pains to try and point out in various books and talks and so on, and believe me, Georgianne, this is a major subject of discussion on my website, in the subscribers area, in my members' vid chats. Almost every time we have a vid chat, someone has seen another aspect of this metaphor that I keep writing about.
Yeah.
We discuss it in much more depth. And this is the aspect that's most disturbing and that I keep trying to point out to people. Because when you go to Egypt and you look at the Hermetic tradition that's coming out of Egypt,
yes,
what you find there is a completely different reading, and in my opinion, probably a much more primitive reading of the metaphor than even the Vedic, in that you have no conception in those Hermetic texts of sacrifice as a payment of a debt,
yeah,
or as a bloody offering or what have you. They will use the term sacrifice in that tradition, but if you look at the way it travels down through history from the Hermetic tradition on into Neoplatonism and so on, which is kind of the popular version of Hermeticism of the day, when they start talking about sacrifice, what they mean is, you know, innocent or harmless little things like burning incense or eating meat that may have been sacrificed in some cases, but they're not talking about human sacrifice.
Okay? Oh, boy.
they mean something else. Now, I'm not certain, you know, this is a subject of more research that I have to do, but I think that at some point that everything I've seen thus far leads me to think that there was some sort of divergence in very, very ancient times prior to the rise of, you know, the Indus Valley civilization or Sumer or Egypt or even the ancient Chinese. I think there was some sort of divergence between cultures inclining towards the sacrificial interpretation of the metaphor and those that did not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting that you have within what I call the alternative media history or the alternative truth community or whatever you wish to call it, back around the turn of the last century, you had a number of people involved in researching all of this stuff that had ties, of course, to theosophy or racial supremacy theories and all of that nonsense that was going on.
Yeah.
But oftentimes these people would do some very interesting bodies of research nonetheless. So you have to kind of treat them with caution when they start going on their racist or bigot rants.
Yeah.
But they do come up with some interesting ideas. And one of the theories that you find being promoted toward the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century is the idea that the Brahmanist culture in Vedic India had some sort of connection to the Abrahamic culture,
yeah,
that you see rising in the Old Testament, beginning with Abram of Ur, who of course eventually becomes Abraham and so on, and the whole Old Testament tradition connected with it. And these people do a number of interesting, in my opinion, sometimes highly questionable philological comparisons between Sanskrit and some of the ancient Mesopotamian languages,
mm-hmm,
but it's the idea itself that they're talking about that intrigues me, not necessarily the way that they're arguing for it.
Well, let me ask another question. When it comes to debt,
uh-huh,
isn't that related to intercourse between a man and a woman and producing a child? to help pay off this debt? And is that one of the primary reasons why they are so against homosexuals?
Well, I
especially the male, because they don't reproduce.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it.
Okay.
That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't get into that in Financial Vipers. But clearly, you have within the tradition of Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity, you have a tradition that sex is a concession to the fall of man.
Yeah.
All right? And there is even a tradition, and most people aren't even aware of this, but there is even a tradition within the Christian church fathers that mankind was created pardon the oxymoronic expression here, but created originally as a masculine or male androgyne.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, that may sound like a contradiction in terms, but that basically is what the tradition is, and that in turn is based on particularly the Greek version of the Old Testament and the way that Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27 read in the Greek. All right?
Yeah.
And there are similar, there are actually similar traditions within rabbinical Judaism. All right, so let's put this into context. If you have the idea that human sin is of such a nature that it can piss off the infinitely righteous God, who becomes infinitely angry and pissed off, and therefore you owe that infinitely pissed off God an infinite debt.
Yeah.
and believe me, folks, the logic is just about that bad.
Yeah.
Right?
It is.
And it ultimately is expressed and given an expression in a medieval treatise by an Archbishop of Canterbury by the name of Anselm in a treatise called Cur Deus Homo. All right? And it's not until, you know, about 1100 that this doctrine actually is codified into this form. So people need to bear that in mind. I'm not taking pot shots at a central Christian dogma, because this was never the doctrine of the Eastern Church, and in many cases you find some of the early fathers looking at the beginnings of this doctrine and saying, well, no, that can't be right.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you are. But anyway, you've got this infinite debt, and therefore you've got mankind that owes the debt, but he can't pay it off because he's not infinite. So God has to become man in order to slaughter himself to pay off the debt.
That's wacky.
Well, of course it is. And you see, the underlying problem is even if you assume the idea of a debt, you're implying the subtle ontological parity of the parties in the transaction.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's another teensy tiny problem. But anyway, you get in that system, you get the idea that sex is a concession to the fall, necessary to preserve the race, to bring about the Messiah who can pay the debt. Okay.
Sounds funky to me.
Well, of course it is. I mean, you know, it's so funky, Georgianne, that people of good conscience in the Christian churches of the West have known that, you know, this is really not a very good doctrine. There was a Swedish bishop by the name of Gustav Aulén, in fact, that wrote a very famous treatise about this whole thing.
Yeah.
And questioning its moral utility.
Yeah.
In a book called Christus Victor. So, you know, it's not that they're, you know, all Christians in the West are holding some cockamamie notion, because there have been voices that have raised concerns about the whole doctrine.
Well,
it remains nonetheless the way that most Western Christians conceive of all of this.
Well, I've got another one and a question with it.
Mm-hmm.
In Numbers 31, mm-hmm. 17 through 18.
Okay, now you've got me scratching my head.
Well, you won't in a minute. The Hebrew Bible, Old
mm-hmm.
Testament,
mm-hmm.
has Moses ordering the Israelite army
mm-hmm.
regarding a recently defeated neighbor
mm-hmm.
to, quote, kill every male among the little ones,
mm-hmm.
and kill every woman
mm-hmm.
that has known a man by lying with him.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
all the women and children that have not known a man by sleeping with him,
mm-hmm.
keep alive for yourselves, boys.
Mm-hmm.
And in verse 36, it tells us that the number of women and children that the Israeli terrorists kept alive for themselves was 32,000. Now,
well, first of all, let's call them Hebrew terrorists.
Okay.
I mean, you know, not Israeli.
Okay.
We're mixing and mismatching terribly historically different periods.
Okay. My question is, if it was to purify everything for the coming of Christ
uh-huh.
to be born,
uh-huh.
then how come that 32,000 of these women and children were kept, and you know they had sex with the women?
Well, of course, son. You know, it's not only that's the problem, but how are you going to determine that they're virgins? I mean, you know, have you got a gynecologist traveling with the army willing to put every last one of them up in the stirrups and find out if the hymen is broken or not? I mean, you start looking at all these problems, and they just keep mounting exponentially. And, you know, that's another one. How can you argue the way all the crazy things that they've argued? You know, I'm not here to defend any of it. I'm just telling you that this is the doctrine, and that's why the doctrine arose. I'm certainly not defending any of it. I left the Western Church for precisely these types of reasons. I never believed in their doctrine of original guilt. I never believed in this bizarre, wacky, sacrificial logic.
Yeah.
And much to my delight, I found out that many of the early fathers of the church didn't either.
Right.
So why am I hanging around here, you know?
But Joseph, they use this garbage to wage their wars even today.
Yes, I know.
And,
I know.
And David Graybor, that you quoted, wrote, "Who has the right to speak for the cosmos or humanity?"
Well, that's my point with constantly bringing up this metaphor.
Yeah.
Because the metaphor, when you really understand it, it's a metaphor of the Creator God of nature. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, nature and nature's God. And when you contemplate the book of nature, you are, to a certain extent, freed. Well, not to a certain extent. You are freed from the necessity of a revealed religious system dependent upon a sacred text.
Yes.
That is either dictated to a guy on top of a mountain by an archangel, or revealed in a flash of light on a road to Damascus.
Yeah.
Or revealed on the top of another mountain amidst thunder and lightning and threats of dire doom if you don't go along with the plan.
Okay. Oh, boy. Yeah.
You know? This is the problem all along. And, you know, lest we think that it's unique to those religions, let's remember that we have very similar claims being acted out with the early UFO contactees. What do? They go out to the desert in California. And what does he claim? He says, well, you guys stay here. I've got to go meet E.T. over the hill here.
Yeah.
You know, and he comes back with a message. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same old snake oil song and dance.
Well, another question is, in the Gospel of John, where they're citing, it cites Psalms, is it not written in your law that ye are gods?
Yes.
What in the heck does that really mean?
Well, I'm wondering what any of this has to do with Financial Vipers of Venice. I'm not talking about any of these things in the book.
Yeah, I lifted this quote out of your book.
Oh, well, yeah, I remember that. The real thing there that I'm trying to get at with that quotation
Yeah.
Is that once you understand the metaphor, you are understanding mankind's, gosh, now you got me flustered because I'm trying to remember.
Oh, bless your heart.
No, that's all right. You begin to understand the position that the metaphor puts you in. You follow me?
Yes.
In other words, you're not dependent on a special revelation. A God in the sky. You are gods. You look within. You know the kingdom of God is within you. What does that mean? Well, I think it means that everyone is a direct manifestation of this process of diversity, of unity in diversity. All right?
Yeah.
The really interesting thing, and the other thing, now it's coming back to me, the other thing I put that in there for was to have people start to think about what possibly was Christ's original message.
Yeah.
And why does it get attached subsequently to this whole Yahwist paradigm again?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's face the facts, Georgian. If you're dealing with this nutty Anselmian doctrine of infinite debt, infinite atonement, God slaughtering himself to pay off the debt, you know, God, you're reducing God to a banker making entries on a ledger book, and you're reducing any relationship that you have to God to mechanism, to
yes.
bookkeeping, to, and to me, this was always very, very foreign.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure what the rest of my process of thinking is. This is the trouble of writing so many dang books.
Yeah. Can't,
when you ask me questions like this, I can't remember half the time what I was thinking when I did it. But the other thing is, when you understand that aspect of the metaphor, you understand that you are a manifestation in and of yourself,
yeah,
of the divine.
Yes.
And if you really understand that, it puts you in a very different relationship to a text
mm-hmm.
that claims sacred status.
Yeah.
Because you're not any more subservient to it.
Right.
You follow? If that's
yeah.
making sense. And, you know, you're asking me a question there about trying to recover the logic of why I put epigraphs in my book. Half the time, Georgianne, I can't remember what I've even written in my own book.
Oh, bless your heart. Oh, Joseph.
So I apologize if I sounded snappy or snitty because
no, you
that,
didn't.
That wasn't my intention. I just couldn't figure out what.
Well, Giordano.
Well, when I was laughing before when we started all of
yeah.
this, I was trying to remember some other things. Anyway, go ahead.
Bless your heart. Joseph.
Yeah.
Oh,
go
my
ahead.
Goodness. Okay.
Remembering what I couldn't remember before.
Gee.
Go ahead. Folks, it's bad.
Yeah. Giordano Bruno.
Yes, Giordano. I do remember writing about him.
Yes. He had a fantastic brain.
Yes, he
and
did.
And he expressed...
Much better than mine right now.
Oh, Joseph. Do you need some coffee?
No. No, I'm not that loopy, but... I sound like it, probably, but
cool.
Go ahead.
Well, what, explain to the audience why Giordano Bruno was such a huge threat to the Venetian bankers as well
as
the Vatican.
Bingo. Well, it's because he understood this metaphor.
Okay.
Of, you know, everything coming out of, quite literally, a nothing.
Yes.
A primordial nothing. And that being God and differentiating himself and ultimately leading to creation, all right?
Yeah.
He understood this very well. He was steeped in that version of the metaphor that comes out of Egypt and out of Hermeticism and subsequently out of Neoplatonism. He understood this.
Yeah.
And because of that influence, first of all, he's not... I lost my train of thought.
Joseph.
Oh, jeez. He's... I think what I was going to say is that he's not thinking in terms, Georgianne, of how do I want to say?
Conventional.
Right. He's not thinking in terms of priests and sacrifice. And,
right.
And, yeah. He's not thinking in terms of any of that. He's thinking in terms of this metaphor representing the God of creation.
Yeah.
And being a metaphor of the creation, therefore, of endless diversity, creativity, fecundity, fertility, virility, you know, all of the adjectives that we could think of to describe this.
Right.
And therefore, he's not thinking in terms that as this metaphor divides itself, you know, in the book I talk about, well, imagine the Venetian understanding of the metaphor. They would assign the value of one to the original nothing.
Yeah.
And any subsequent differentiations or diversifications of that original unity is going to be fractional.
Right.
And as you increase the diversity, you increase the fractions. Okay, in other words, you've got a typical banker's double entry ledger zero sum game going on here. Okay?
Yeah.
With Bruno, on the other hand, viewing the metaphor not as a metaphor of debt and fractions and splitting everything up, you have a metaphor of production, of creativity, and therefore everything that's produced, it becomes a countable entity.
Uh-huh.
You know, one, two, three, four, five,
yeah.
Instead of one, one half, one third.
Yeah.
So that's the other part of Bruno. Now, because he's talking about the metaphor, oh boy, I've done it again.
I'm
so
the
sorry.
One that suffered from the gas thing in my house.
I know, sure.
And I'm doing pretty good.
You're doing a lot better than I am, girl, I tell you.
Check for a gas leak in there.
Oh, Georgia, don't say that. You're going to have the whole world laughing your head off.
I mean a real gas leak.
I know.
It almost killed me, Joseph.
I know, hon. I'm not laughing at you.
I know.
I'm laughing at how these words could be taken.
Yeah, that's right.
This is the danger of live radio, folks. You're listening to it right now.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
What was I saying?
Giordano Bruno.
What about him? I've completely forgotten what I was saying.
Oh, gosh. Well,
don't tell me you have too.
I remember the question.
Well, you're doing a lot better than I am because I don't remember the question.
I wrote it down. That's why I remember it.
Well, listen, folks, I've been having that kind of day, if you can't tell.
Oh.
All right, go ahead.
Well, he was such a huge threat to the Vatican and the bankers.
Okay, yeah.
Why?
Well, let's get to the Vatican part of it. The metaphor, if you look at it, is it's a Trinitarian structure.
Yeah.
And yet it's not produced because of any revelation. it's produced because of a certain way of conceptualizing the physical medium.
Yeah.
And the diversity that results from it.
Right.
Now, as such, it may or may not be correct, but at least it is a product of reason. So you don't need revelation to embrace
right.
it. And once you say that, that's the first strike against Bruno. The second strike against him was because of the metaphor. He went on to say, just as I've said many times, that any person or entity claiming to speak as God or for the cosmos or whatever is ipso facto false.
Yeah.
Because the metaphor is open to everybody.
Yeah.
To perceive and understand. And even to perceive or, pardon me, to misperceive or misunderstand.
Well, didn't he believe that consciousness was not local?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He hints very strongly at it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It may be too strong of a word to say that he believed it was not local. But,
yeah.
But, yeah, I think he did. The bottom line is when he's presenting his understanding of it, he's obviously challenging the Venetian understanding. He's showing that you don't have a special class that can manipulate or speak for the metaphor either financially or religiously.
Right.
And, you know, he might as well have said, I intend, well, he actually did say in so many words on some occasions, that I intend to replace this current socio-religio-economic system with something entirely different and truly open to everybody.
Uh-huh.
You know, he actually did fully intend his understanding to be the new religion of Europe.
Uh-huh.
To replace Christianity altogether.
It might have been a good idea.
It might have, but we need to be very careful because there have been people who've looked at certain aspects of the metaphor and acted upon it in a political sense.
Yeah.
You can trace directly certain readings of the metaphor, misreadings in my opinion, to the French Revolution.
Oh.
So, you know, it's not a guarantee of right behavior or right thinking, because as I've pointed out, it's capable of being interpreted in a number of different ways, some more legitimate than others.
Okay.
So, yeah, you have to be very careful. If you read Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Bavarian Illuminati,
yeah.
You can read passages in him, it's very clear that he has an understanding of some aspects of this. But yet he takes his understanding and says, well, if this is true, then we need to get rid of all princes and priests.
Yeah.
And what he means get rid of, he means get rid of.
Yeah.
Okay, you know?
Yeah.
Now, no re-education in that system.
Hmm. Well, you also, in your book, quoted John 12:25,
yes,
where Christ says, those who love life will lose it,
mm-hmm.
and those who don't will save it. How are we to take that?
Well, again, I don't remember why I put it there or in what chapter it's in. I don't remember where it is in the book. Can you tell me what chapter it's in or what?
No.
Oh.
I didn't write that part down.
12:25. I don't honestly remember, hon, and I'm terribly sorry. I can't remember anything today. No, I'm sorry. I'm just drawing a complete blank.
Well, then why are there so many parallelisms between the Hermetica and the Christian Canonical Gospels?
Ah, okay. I think I remember the
yeah.
context of the John 12:25 thing. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, folks, sometimes you have to knock me upside the head with the baseball bat.
Oh. I swear, you sound just like your stove is leaking gas.
No, hon, I'm serious. It's just been one of those days. That's the reason I called you early, because it's been one of those days where I have forgotten just about everything I set out to do, or I've been in the middle of a couple projects today, and I got up, I'm not talking about your question, but I got up at one point in the middle of writing something and went into the kitchen to fix my iced tea.
Yeah.
Came back, and I started something completely different, and I forgot all about what I had been doing.
Oh, my goodness.
Until about 2 hours later. And I had stopped in the middle of a sentence. I couldn't.
How old are you, Joseph? Oh, boy.
I couldn't remember what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
So it's just been an awful day. I have them occasionally charging.
I know.
I can't remember anything I'm doing. All right. But in this case, I think I can remember. The Hermetica was, if you read the Hermetica, the texts make the claim that they are based on the teaching of the Egyptian wisdom god.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah. Egyptian. You're doing fine.
Thank you. I'll be taking more of my electroshock after we're done. But anyway, the Hermetica claimed to be the teaching of the Egyptian wisdom god Tehuta, all right?
Yeah.
Now, Tehuta predates Moses.
Yes.
All right. So when the Renaissance humanists in northern Italy translate these texts that they get from, most likely from Byzantium, and translate them into Latin and make them available to Western readers.
Yes.
What happens is the texts are taken at their word. In other words, the tendency back then was to view them as exactly what they claimed to be, the hidden wisdom teachings of an ancient Egyptian god passed down through history that predate Moses.
Yeah.
And therefore, people like Bruno view them as containing the Prisca Theologica, or the primordial theology of pre-Noah times.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
And therefore, they begin to be seen as purer in conception than the Gospels. And when you see these people reading the Hermetica and then going on and reading the Gospels, they obviously notice some parallels, particularly in the Gospel of John.
Yes.
All right. And I believe when you asked me about John 12:25, that there is a reference in the Hermetica that is very, very similar to that particular text.
I think
that's what I was talking about. Now that my memory...
Now that it's come back?
Now that it's come back, you know, thank goodness my therapist lets me have a cherry tongue suppressor. But now, what happened to the Hermetica is in the early 17th century, you had a philologist in Great Britain by the name of Isaac Casaubon.
Yes.
Right? And he subjected the entire text of the Hermetica to a very careful, close philological analysis. And he pointed out that many of the Greek terms used in the Greek text weren't even words prior to the 2nd century A.D.
Oh, my goodness.
So in other words, they couldn't possibly have been dated to the time even of Plato, much less Tehuta.
Yeah.
All right? And therefore, the texts were fraudulent.
Oh, my gosh.
And therefore, the whole Hermetic enterprise that you saw building up during the Renaissance collapsed.
Oh.
It literally went underground, Georgianne.
Yeah.
Because Casaubon, took, you know, took the wind out of the sails. You couldn't claim that this stuff represented any sort of ancient wisdom anymore because the texts were far too late.
Yeah.
They weren't even as old as the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the end of the story. What has happened in recent scholarship, Georgianne, mm-hmm. is, and particularly some people at Oxford, is they have begun to re-examine Isaac Casaubon's assumptions.
Yes.
Because when you look at the Egyptian wisdom tradition, the first thing that you see in it is that it presents many of its texts in dialogue form between a master and his pupil.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you see in the Hermetica. Then you see certain little details in the Hermetica itself that could only have been put there by someone with a very detailed, thorough, conversant knowledge,
huh.
not only of Egyptian geography, but in many cases of Egyptian, it's of the Egyptian religion. So in other words, the texts do have details that connect them to ancient Egypt in a time prior to their actual writing.
Oh my goodness.
Now, the final nail in the Casaubon coffin is that in ancient times, Georgianne, you didn't necessarily put the name of the author writing the book on
yeah.
the book like we do today.
Mm-hmm.
The tradition back then was you honored the inspiration for your writing by honoring the person you ultimately claimed inspired it.
Yeah.
So in other words, you could claim, and it was very common practice, you could claim that something was by Tehuda if he stood in the tradition of concepts that inspired your work.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, the tendency of modern scholarship is to say that much of the Hermetica really is Egyptian, and that the surface, the Greek text itself, is simply disguising this fact.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, Casaubon has almost been completely reversed. And I should point out, in the last 20 years.
Wow.
So, you know, in a certain sense, then, it's vindicating the view of the Italian Renaissance humanists, people like Bruno and
yeah.
Campanella and all of the Pico de Mirandola and all of the Italian Renaissance philosophers. And there's another one, too. I can't remember his name. We'll get through it, Georgianne.
Yes.
Hang in there.
Well, did that bring up about the verse, John 12:25?
Well, yeah, because in the Hermetica, that I mentioned that earlier, in the Hermetica you have, as I recall, a similar sort of statement.
Ah.
And Casaubon pointed that out. Well, the Hermetica couldn't possibly have been the basis for the statement in the Gospels. It's the other way around. Because remember what he said about certain Greek terms. They weren't even words, known
yeah.
words, you know, at the time, supposedly, that the Hermetica were written. So that's, you know, it was one of the examples that he used, as I recall. And again, folks, take my bad memory tonight with a considerable bag of salt, because I don't know if my memory is correct in this instance.
Well, with the Vatican,
mm-hmm.
when was it actually proclaimed to be the Vatican?
Well, it's called that because that's the hill it's on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the modern term. Back then, it simply would have been known as the Apostolic Say, both in religious and diplomatic circles. And in fact, that would be the technical term that you would use in diplomatic discourse, you know, as an ambassador or whatever, the Holy Say or the Apostolic Say or whatever. But the other thing that people have to remember is that the papacy during the Middle Ages was not located quite in the same spot.
Yeah.
The old Basilica of St. Peter's, the one that the papacy was associated with back then is not the structure that's there now. The structure that's there now, of course, was built during the Renaissance. The old basilica was a Romanesque structure. The papacy resided in the old Lateran palace of the Roman emperors and so on. So it wasn't quite the same spot. Close, but not quite. The old basilica, I don't even remember, George, like everything else tonight. I can't remember exactly where it was located.
I received a picture from one of our friends who recently, he's from, I believe, Norway. He recently went to Rome, and he had a picture taken of himself standing in front of the basilica with your book right in front of him.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah. Bless his heart.
Well, good for him. Which book was it?
I couldn't really see.
You can't remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
But well, it was your book.
Well, that's cool. I'm sorry I'm so bad tonight, George Ann, with my memory. But
that's okay.
Like I say, it's been one of those days.
Well, with the Inquisitions and all of that that went on, why... Really, the real reason why they launched the Inquisition.
Oh, boy. You know, in the way that you're asking the question, it's a really good question. And I do not honestly know. You know, there's all sorts of academic answers.
Yeah.
But I suspect that you... The reason for your question is that you suspect that none of the answers are really correct.
Right.
Or go deep enough. And
right.
I've suspected the same thing. Let me put it this way. And I'm gonna crawl way out on the limb and do our usual high-octane speculation. If you look at the people that came to the attention of the Inquisition.
Yeah.
You have to look behind the term heretic that is used of these people and examine who they really were and what they really thought.
Yeah.
All right. In many cases, you had people that simply did not accept, for whatever reason, the claimed authority of the papacy.
Right.
Okay, that's reason number one. But you have to look even deeper. If you look at the Spanish Inquisition,
yes,
you're dealing principally with alleged Jews, but you have to understand that the Jews in Spain were steeped in esoteric Judaism.
Yeah.
It's from the Spanish Jews that we get the Kabbalah. It's from the Spanish Jews that we get famous works of esoteric Judaism like the Zohar and Moses Maimonides and these people that come out of that whole esoteric tradition. In other words, with the Jews of Spain, you're dealing with people that, while on the one hand they have a very direct connection to one of the Yahwist religions, on the other hand, they are dealing with esoteric systems that ultimately have nothing to do with it.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
If you turn then to the Albigensians, to the Cathars in the Languedoc in southern France,
right,
you're dealing again with a group of people with a direct preservation of certain esoteric traditions having directly to do with the metaphor. Okay?
Okay.
If you turn to the Hussites in Bohemia, again, you have a group of people that deny the authority of the papacy, that want a reform of the church, but if you look at the kind of atmosphere or culture in Bohemia at that time, this is where many of the Holy Roman Emperors had their capital maintained in Prague. They were heavy sponsors, many of them, of esoteric studies, alchemical studies, and so on and so forth. So again, you have this alchemical hermetic influence at work,
yes,
in forming some of the ideas of some of these pre-reformer reformers, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you turn the clock even further, if you look at the Venetian Fourth Crusade, which has nothing to do with the Inquisition, but if you look at what I think they were ultimately after,
yeah,
by diverting to Constantinople, I think they were after knowledge. And more specifically, they wanted to suppress knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
That they may have suspected, and I think strongly, I strongly suspect they did suspect, was there in the imperial archives. So in other words, if you look at the suppression of the Templars by the French Inquisition, what do you have again? You have an order that, interestingly enough, is involved in international banking.
Yeah.
But if you scratch and sniff around their belief system, what little survives of it, you quickly gain the impression that these people are really not part of the Christian culture of the medieval church at all.
Yeah.
So again, that you have a certain common thread, Georgian, speculating wildly again, that what unites all of these people is they've got some connection, some influence from this esoteric tradition,
uh-huh,
tied deeply to the metaphor. It's influencing their ideas, and for whatever reason, the powers that be sense that the way that these particular groups are developing this tradition is ultimately a threat from within to the power of the medieval church and to its ideas and concepts. That's what I think the common thread may be. And again, I'm speculating wildly. I hope people understand that.
Yeah.
Because the way my mind is functioning tonight, I don't think
Jesus.
I'd be
bless your heart.
Sorry.
Oh. Well,
too much work, Georgiana, and too little sleep, I think.
Yeah, you probably need a vacation.
Oh boy, you said it.
Oh, well, Joseph, this book is fascinating, and
oh, thank you.
I haven't completely gotten through it yet, but my gosh, you've got.
I can't remember it.
You've got so much information in here.
Yeah, it does have a lot of information.
And what do you mean by monetizing the metaphor?
Well, essentially, the metaphor has, as I point out in the book, it has a financial fiduciary, I should say, rather, aspect.
Yeah.
A numismatic aspect would be even a better term.
Coinage?
Coinage, yes. Because what does bullion come to represent? Well, you've got the abstract bullion itself before it's coined.
Yeah.
Which is symbolic of that medium, physical medium or nothingness itself. When you have that medium differentiated, you have coins.
Wow.
Individual coins. And the interesting thing, Georgiana, is that this connection, you know, I'm not the one that made this connection. It was made by another scholar, either Oxford or Cambridge. I can't remember.
That's okay.
there, Joseph. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
But the man's name is Seaford. And he wrote a book, very, very profound book, that I refer to in Financial Vipers. And he suggests that essentially the metaphor or the cosmology arises after and because of the influence of coinage.
Oh.
Because it's so easy to, as you said, wow, you know, it's, once you see it,
yeah,
it's obvious, it's there. But the fact of the matter is that the metaphor, as anybody who's studied it, you know, it has a Vedic version. It has an Egyptian version. And those versions predate the emergence of coinage.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what I pointed out in Financial Vipers is if you look, therefore, at who's pushing coinage in Greece, guess who it is?
Who?
The Pythagoreans.
Oh, yes.
Ooh.
Ah, yes.
Oh.
Pythagoras and his homunculus.
Yeah, Pythagoras and his secret society and its very peculiar claims to ties to ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt and so on. In other words, it looks to me as if you have a hidden elite steeped in this whole ancient metaphor idea.
Yeah.
Deliberately then using it or construing it to create a new system of money.
Oh.
And notice what this new system of money does. I hope people caught it. Because if you recall, in Babylon's Banksters, George Ann, I talked about the little cuneiform clay tablets that were in use in Sumeria.
Yeah.
As money.
And okay. Sticks.
And sticks and whatever, you know, whatever. Yeah. And so long as you're not attempting to do international trade, that works.
Oh, boy.
You know, it's just like Ithaca ours.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, exchange your cuneiform tablet at your local participating merchant. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So that's what you have. But if you're going to conduct international trade with, say, China, and you take your cuneiform tablet to a merchant in ancient Beijing or what have you, or Shanghai,
yeah.
Are they going to honor it? No, probably not, because it doesn't represent anything of value to them, that they can use in their society. What about bullion?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. That'll work.
Yeah. That's right.
So you see, at a certain point in human history, you see something happen suddenly all over the world, the then-known world, more or less kind of simultaneously, which to me suggests that, no, this isn't happening by accident. There's a group of people behind it pushing it to push the world into more widely spread political units. You know, this is the age of the rise of the great empires.
Yeah.
And pushing the world into greater contact with remoter parts of it. And I can say that with some confidence, Georgian, because there's something I didn't mention in the book that I hope people caught. This is part of my deliberate placing of dots in different books to make people think about the interconnections. And this is one of them, okay?
Okay.
I'm letting part of the secret out of the bag.
Okay.
Let's turn back to Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And in the second chapter, I do remember that. it was the second chapter, by golly. In the second chapter of that book, I pointed out that the ancient system of weights and measures, you can't have commerce, can you, without a system of weights and measures.
Right.
Now, what does bullion do? Bullion is going to weigh the same, because it is of the same mass, of the same element, anywhere in the world.
Right.
Okay? So in order to conduct international trade, the first thing you have to have is some basis of measures and weights that are universal. And the only way you can do that, forget all this nonsense they taught you in the history books, it's wrong, about ancient systems being based on body parts. If you study ancient systems of measures, they're not based on any such stupid thing. They're based on geodetic and astronomical phenomena, which are going to be universal. That was that system, Georgianne, if you read that chapter of the book, was put into place so long ago, it predates every known human civilization.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Even Thomas Jefferson saw this.
Wow.
Yeah, and he even says, well, this is a system of weights and measures coming down from high antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The next thing that you have to have for international commerce, besides a geodetic and astronomically based system of weights and measures, is you have to have a medium of exchange that will be consistent in those systems of weights and measures and valued around the world.
Yeah.
And that's when you see bullion arise. Aha. No.
Yeah. Well, what about today?
Well, again, you know,
because, Joseph, everybody's talking about, oh, there's going to be this collapse, and your money's not going to be any good, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, just scare
yes.
you to death.
Well, I'm not a financial expert or predictor. You know, like you, I can remember way back, and that part of my memory is working, folks. My short-term memory is not so good tonight. But I can remember hearing talk of this all my life, George Ann.
Yeah.
The problem is, I think that is going to happen. I really do think we are in a period of, like I've said so many times, of unique transition in world history, unlike anything previously in human history.
Right.
Except maybe that cosmic war that, you know, in my opinion, happened millions of years ago.
Yeah.
But I think we're in that period. And one of the things that is being examined is precisely money. What is it?
Mm-hmm.
What is it really? And who does it represent? And who should have control of its issuance or emission?
Right.
We're seeing this, and it's, you know, I've got bad news for you banksters. It is not going to go away.
Right.
Your attempts to control it is just not going to go away. The technology is forcing the change faster than the ability to keep it all bottled up in a monopoly central bank. That's just the reality.
Right.
I think, Georgianne, what may happen and probably has to happen at some point is we have to get back to an idea of money as representative of production, creativity, and value.
Yeah.
Rather than monetized debt.
Yes.
The system that we've been operating under for far too long in the West.
Yeah.
With this monetized debt, and in this country really since the creation of the Federal Reserve and possibly before that,
mm-hmm.
it's just not a wise system. Because ultimately it's not very stable. And really, you know, if you look back at human history, there has never been a stable system of money.
Right.
That's the secret that no one wants to tell you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've looked at Austrian school economics, I've looked at Keynesian economics, and the few economists that actually do talk about money rather than simply economics, I haven't found anywhere a system that can guarantee stability over time.
Right.
And, you know, they ought to get a clue here. This is one reason I keep talking about the connection between finance and physics.
Yes.
Because in physics, you must take account of time and the changes of time on a system or the changes of a system in time. And, you know, the idea that there is some absolute money out there, just like the idea that there's some sort of absolute space out there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we need an Einsteinian revolution in economics.
Oh, yeah.
They're still thinking in Newtonian terms, and it's just not working. and, you know, I'm not, people think I'm against bankers. I'm not against bankers, you know.
Another question. When a bank is brought to court
mm-hmm.
and they're fined, say, $50 billion for fraud.
Yes, this in my book, too, because I don't remember.
No, no. It's just a question.
Okay. I was worried, George Annie.
Oh.
You should have seen the look on my face.
I wish I could have.
Did I write that? Am I losing my mind or not?
No.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. A bank or an investment house is brought to court,
right,
and they get a judgment against them for, say, hypothetically, $50 billion
okay,
for fraud against homeowners.
Okay.
Who gets that $50 million?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would depend on the country. It would depend on the type
in, of... In the U.S.
In the U.S. Well, I would assume the government does.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, aha, bingo.
Yeah.
It's not the people defrauded.
Right.
You know, this is the big, this is the big problem. There's no restitution of wrongs. And
yeah.
You know, the mortgage bubble, the credit default swaps, the fraudulent mortgages, all of this, I think, was enabled, quite literally, in legal parlance, by inducement to fraud.
Yeah.
You know, it's and pardon me here, folks, if I'm stepping on any political toes, but, you know, you can keep your doctor if you want your doctor, period. You can keep your health insurance plan,
yeah,
if you want, like your health insurance plan, period, while knowing all along that this wasn't the case.
Right.
That's inducement to fraud. That's bait and switch. It's,
yep,
not. It's beyond lying. It's inducement to fraud. It is a crime. It is a felony. So, you know, when you read about what went on in the financial markets, you laugh because it just it's so big, it's so gigantic, and it's in some cases, Georgian. And I don't want to sound like I'm trying to defend the banksters here, but in some cases, the financial markets themselves have become so complex that they're out of the hands of the banksters.
Yeah.
And in the hands of computer programmers and physicists, quite literally. So, you know, where's the end of all of this? I think the end of all of this is that you have a virtual economy that's all of this paper and electronic blips floating around the world.
Yeah.
And then you have real economy, which is concerned with making things.
Yeah.
Or performing a service, be it playing a piano in a bar to, you know, painting someone's house, whatever. That to me is real economy.
Well, Joseph, you know, when they passed the NAFTA-GATT thing,
mm-hmm,
they would have had to know that millions, tens of millions of jobs would be leaving this country.
Of course.
And they did it intentionally on purpose and have left a lot of people homeless and in the streets. I mean, and now they've got TPP, which is...
Yeah. The
horrific
partnership. You
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's horrific. It gives corporations the right to sue states.
Yeah, I believe it.
You know, if say for example, if Texas does not want anything from Monsanto, no growing genetically modified crops in Texas, well, Monsanto can come in and say, "You've harmed us financially," and sue them.
Well, yeah, that aspect of it is very disturbing because it strips people of any last shred of representation and of political power. It's a corporate state.
Yeah.
The corporation becomes the state, and I got to tell you, folks, corporations. If you think corporation, if you're living in the world of Ayn Rand,
yeah,
and think this is all a wonderful idea, think again, because the corporate culture comes out of the doctrine of the corporate person.
Yeah.
It requires you to tailor your individual thoughts and responsibility to that of a bureaucracy. And I'm sorry, corporations have done a lot of good in history, but right now they're doing a lot of bad.
Well, what if we just ignore them and do what we want to do anyway?
Well, I think that's happening. You know, the other thing that is, you know, kind of defying the trends is that you have the formation of smaller communities.
Yeah.
And smaller on a global basis. I mean, just think of the people that listen to this radio show.
Yeah.
You know, via the internet. Well, they're spread all over the world, but the community is formed by the shared ideas.
Yes.
And this is something that, you know, they can try and control all they want to, and they probably will, but, you know, you cannot. This is so basic. Sooner or later, humanity is going to learn the lesson. You cannot breed out, weed out, legislate out, or even zap or drug out the human desire for individual liberty.
Right.
The only thing you can do by any of those means is temporarily suppress it.
Yeah.
And the bottom line, folks, is the spiritual truth is though the devil may want worship and may have means to compel it, in the very act of doing so, he loses what he desires.
Yeah.
A compelled respect, a compelled obedience, a compelled love is really not respect or obedience or love.
Right.
You know, this, it's a self-defeating enterprise that these people are engaged upon.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
It never ceases to amaze me, Georgianne, how stupid and idiotic they really are.
Oh.
You know, some of them are true men without chests. They're people who truly have no humanity and no heart and could care less. They're out for themselves.
Right.
And it doesn't matter how many bodies they have to climb over.
Yeah.
But even those people, if they had their way, if their world were ever to come true, they would be bereft of the very support network, having climbed over so many bodies, that would keep them alive.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's insanity.
Well, I tend to think that kind of person,
yeah,
that it is a genetic trait.
Well, and Georgianne, I tend to think that you're probably right there I think you're on to something. The reason I think that is kind of long and complicated, but and you've said, we've had this discussion privately and so on, and I've kind of changed my views. I'm coming around more to your way of thinking, and the reason I think that is that when Dr. DeHart and I were writing Transhumanism, we ran across the fact that the U.S. government is sponsoring these behavioral genetics studies.
Yes.
I think we talked before when we talked about that book on your show about Oak Ridge investigating people who, you know, the genetic code of people who could wiggle their ears, curl their tongues, or are alcoholics or homosexuals, you know, as, you know, why that odd, weird list?
Right.
And it's all being done under the auspices of behavioral genetics. Well, what's behavioral genetics? Well, for one thing, it's a, like molecular biology, it's partly been a concept or a discipline that has been pushed by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, take it for what it is. You know, that whole family fortune is basically due to a thug, a common criminal,
yeah,
that beat his competition into submission.
Yeah.
So, you know, forget about this capitalist myth that he's some sort of great hero. He's not. He's a common thug.
Yes. Yes, he is.
And, you know, this family is the great aristocracy. The aristocracy, you know, the great Randian aristocracy of money. No, I'm sorry. He's just a common thug. Behavioral genetics is the idea that there's some sort of link between environment and genetics.
Yeah.
That there may be certain genetic predilections that can be activated or suppressed by the environmental context.
Yeah.
You know, a genetic predisposition isn't the same thing as a determination that, you know, someone's going to end up with the ability to be an alcoholic or wiggle their ears.
You know? Yeah.
So I think these people suspect something about themselves.
Yeah. They're different, Joseph.
Well, yeah.
They have no conscience. No mercy, no forgiveness, no...
Well, that's my point. It's not something that can be bred out.
Yeah.
It may be a predilection that can be brought out. You see the difference?
Yeah.
They may be looking for ways to engineer things that are contrary to an individual's genome or what have you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But, yeah, I do increasingly tend to think that there's just certain kinds of people or families, you know, that I personally wouldn't want anything to do with.
Yeah.
You know, and I've met people in some of these big-name families.
Oh.
And the more I look at their record, you know, these are not people I want to bite over for Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. You know? Oh, boy.
I just, you know, I don't want to take the chance. They may be nice.
Well, even the devil can be nice for a little while. I mean, gee.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Yeah.
Joseph Goebbels could be quite charming, you know, but
yeah.
I certainly don't want him to my parties.
Yeah.
Not that I have parties, but you understand what I mean. It's just, it's any more to me, Georgiana, it's like voting for the Nazi party if you were to see it on a ballot. Well, we're new now, you know, we've changed. All that's in the past. Well, you know, I've said before, I won't vote for the Democratic Party because it supported slavery.
Yeah.
And you can tell me about all the wonderful projects and programs they put into place since then. I'm sorry. I think slavery of any form is barbaric.
Well, but Joseph, we have slavery today.
Well, of course we do.
I mean,
different guises.
Yes. They have come to the understanding that the planet is like a giant plantation. And
well, they're certainly trying to turn it into that.
Yeah.
And they're well on their way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But, Georgiana, it's like I say, humanity... They've been trying to engineer this project for a millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they manage to get it put into place here or there, it crumbles.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, it's not a plan. And I'm probably going to be speaking way out of line here. But it's ultimately not a plan that emanates or could emanate from within humanity itself.
Yeah.
Because the plan is inhuman.
Yes, it is. That's huge, Joseph.
Yeah, I know it is.
It's just huge. I mean, every day, there are 40, 50, 100, 200, 320 people that are literally murdered in Iraq.
Yeah.
And the same all over the Middle East and even in South America. Look at all the interference that this country has run against other nations. And now they're going after Venezuela.
Oh, I know. But, you know,
what gives us the right to poke our nose in other people's business?
Power. It's not a right, it's power. It's pure power.
Gee.
But what I was referring to are these utopian or dystopian schemes, you know, the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany. when you have societies that are based around an inhuman idea,
ultimately, yes,
they crumble.
Yeah.
That's
after,
why I
after
don't,
millions of people are killed.
Unfortunately, that's usually the case.
Look at the Siege of Leningrad.
Oh, unfortunately, that's usually the case. Oh. I'm not even talking about World War II. I'm talking about what the Soviet system did to its own people, not what Adolf Hitler did to it.
You know,
he was busy doing other hideous things to his own people.
Yeah.
But these schemes, you know, we're going to help you. We're going to take care of you. These are always the famous last words of inhuman schemes.
Right.
And the origin of such schemes, in my opinion, therefore, must be inhuman.
Yes.
That's why they will never work.
Right.
Well,
if since they arise out of the abyss of inhuman mentalities, are the ones that have this drive in them, this kind of mentality, it's more than just mind control, Joseph. It's more than
it is a machine.
Yes.
This is the other thing about the metaphor. And again, this is perhaps letting things out of the bag to come.
Okay.
I've pointed out in many books that there is an atheistic way to interpret the metaphor and a theistic way. It's one and the same metaphor.
Yeah.
And you can advance good reasons for both interpretations.
Yeah.
There is a indebtedness way to interpret, and there is a production way to interpret it.
Yeah.
There is a machine, pardon me, there is an impersonal way of interpreting it and a profoundly personal way of interpreting it.
Yeah.
There is a randomness way of interpreting it and a profoundly orderly, intelligent design way, as it were, of interpreting it.
Yeah.
And finally, there is a machine way of interpreting it and a love way of interpreting it. It's the same thing.
What do you mean it's the same
thing? It's the same metaphor. It's exactly the same.
It's the interpretation.
It's how you're going to construe it. And if you take one path, it's going to lead you to the machine.
Yeah.
When you have people that are behaving like machines, they've given themselves to a machine.
Yeah.
You can be intelligent. You can have a cosmically sized intellect.
Yeah.
And be utterly devoid of intelligent emotion.
Right. Well, they're talking about producing what we would call robots that will independently decide whether you're a good person or a bad person, and if you're a bad person, the robot kills you.
No, exactly. Machine.
Yeah.
Machine. Mm. And humanity wasn't made to be reduced to a machine.
Right.
How many old texts do we have to read to see this? And incidentally, the people trying to reduce humanity to the status of a machine are usually the so-called gods.
Yeah.
And it has never worked. Mm. It never, ever will. Because this life form and this universe are not programmed, so to speak, in that way.
Yeah.
To assume otherwise is to assume a kind of rebellion.
Yeah. Good grief, Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh. Well, yikes.
Yeah, yikes.
Oh.
Yeah, we're in for deep doo-doo.
Yeah, we are. We definitely are.
But I can assure you, the people advocating these things, the Bilderberg meetings and the councils on foreign relations and all of the harebrained cockamamie toads that attend those things and think that they're doing wonderful things. Those that do have hearts left, you cannot persuade to do evil without at some point trying to make an argument based on a perverted good.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are nothing but machines, they will fail.
Yeah.
They will fail absolutely and utterly.
Oh, I pray so, I'll tell you.
Well, I do too, but...
Oh.
Like I say, there are things built in that prevent that whole program from ever succeeding. The program that they're on is a virus.
Yeah.
And it requires an actual program in order to attach itself to.
Yeah.
It cannot survive on its own.
Yeah, that's right.
And the more it attempts to reduce everything to mechanism and machine. I mean, my word, Georgianne, the people that you're talking about, that I'm talking about right now, these people have a worldview, a mechanistic, materialistic worldview that is being shattered by the very scientists that they have helped train through their own universities.
Yeah.
It's being totally shattered. So in other words, the culture that they fought that they could bring about by their banks, by their corporations, and so on, that they first began dreaming of in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the scientific worldviews of the 18th and 19th centuries, that scientific worldview is collapsing. It won't work. It doesn't work. And you still have the same sort of worldview being promoted by these would-be world masters.
Yeah.
That alone dooms it.
Well, if that collapses, nature hates a vacuum, so what takes its place, Joseph?
I don't know, but this is the reason why I keep telling people that, number one, inform yourselves, preserve as much history and culture in your own immediate circle as you can.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, the world that the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Brzezinskis and the Kissingers and the... you know, the Hollands in France, the world that these people live in and dream for everybody is misery.
Yeah.
You can see it in their eyes. You can see it on their sagging faces,
mm-hmm.
that these are miserable people, and they want to have everyone else join them in their misery.
Yeah, that's
and they
true.
They have no culture that is not fake. They cannot sit and listen to Mozart or Bach with real interior understanding
right.
of what it was that produced those things. They have to buy it. And when you have to buy that kind of understanding, you will never have understanding.
Right.
So these people are incapable of creating a human culture. That's why it looks the way it does right now. That's why it's insane.
Well, if they're not capable of identifying with humanity, that means that they are that part of them is blocked or knocked out or bred out.
It's not
out.
There. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, whatever the reason is. But, you know, whatever fills whatever is left after these people have been shown for the frauds and incompetence and inhuman monsters that and parasites that they are.
Yeah.
Whatever's left has to be preserved by everyday people.
Yeah.
That's where society has always been. That's where it was always going to be. The great artists, poets, musicians, composers, architects, the people that have made the world have never been the wealthy or the super rich. Have you noticed this?
Right.
I'm sorry, Ayn Rand, your model's wrong.
Yeah.
J.S. Bach wasn't rich.
Right.
Mozart died in a pauper's grave. No one knows where he is.
Right.
Okay. The people that have humanized culture, the Newtons, the Leibniz. Newton died wealthy, but not super rich.
Wasn't he the director?
Yeah, at one time he was the master of the British Mint.
Oh yeah.
But you know, for the most part, the great names of culture and history that have passed on things of value, human value.
Mm-hmm.
These people were not, they weren't the Midas Mulligans of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. They weren't.
Right.
They weren't the Dagny Taggarts and people like that. They were people that made things, to be sure. They were people that manufactured things, to be sure. But, I think that there's truth in the saying that when you're that wealthy,
yeah,
and you're still out for power, then there's something else motivating you.
Oh, yeah.
It's no longer about creativity, and it's no longer about production. There's some occult influence at work.
Yeah.
And I mean the word in all of its senses.
Yes. Wow. Oh, Joseph. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, hon, for putting up with a very bad memory. It's been, like I say, I probably need sleep. I've been overworking and staying up too late.
Yeah.
And forgetting things that I'm in the middle of.
Yeah. Well, it happens to me all the time. I just chalk it up to gas leaks.
It happens to me too, but usually in the form of absent-mindedness of one sort or another, not outright forgetfulness. And I, yesterday and today have just been really, really, really bad.
Difficult.
Yeah, they have. You know, when you're having one of those days, you set something down.
Yeah.
And you forget where you put it.
Well.
And then you go to look for it, and you can't see it, and it's right in front of you.
Well, remember my camera?
Yeah.
I mean, it just disappeared, Joseph. I've torn the house apart, and I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, listen, I've done worse things, son. I've been looking for a deck of cards, and I finally found it. You know where it was?
Where?
In the freezer.
Oh, gosh. Oh. Must protect those cards, boy.
Yes.
You know, speaking of cards, that brings up astrology.
Uh-huh.
And it's so funny because it deals with cycles.
Yes.
And who was it, Abraham or Moses, that forbid the people to even learn of those things?
Mm-hmm.
I think we understand why.
Well, look, if you're, yeah, precisely, if you're looking at cycles, you know, forbidding the study of the cycles of the heavens.
Yes.
You're really forbidding people from having the very system of just weights and measures that the other part of your law dictates that they have.
Yeah.
So what you're really doing when you put the two contradictory sets of data together is you're empowering an elite.
Yeah, well, I think that's what that's all about.
Bingo, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's...
Well, like right now, they're saying, oh, the emissions is causing climate change, and there's too many people on the planet. And, you know, they study cows, passing gas and stuff and all that. I mean, it's just a bunch of BS. Have they not heard of cycles?
Of course.
You know?
Of course.
I mean, they wouldn't even mention it if they didn't plan to get rich off of it.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah.
That's their only motivation.
Yeah.
You know, it's not money that's evil, it's the love of it.
Yes.
You know, that's the root of it, and it's an interesting... It's an interesting saying.
Yes, it is.
You know, I've met certain individuals from some of those big families, and they didn't strike me as particularly evil. They didn't strike me as particularly intelligent, but it's just the knowledge of the history of some of the things that those families have done that I would never admit someone like that into my life.
Never.
Ever.
Absolutely. Oh. Oh, Joseph.
I know. Thanks for putting up with my...
Thank you.
Well, hopefully next time I won't be so scatterbrained and out of sorts and sleepy and everything else. But so.
Well, everybody, if you haven't gotten it, get Financial Vipers of Venice, Joseph Farrell's new book, and... It's quite a read, let me tell you.
Yeah, I'll have to read it myself.
Yeah, you've got so much. Gosh, Joseph. You've got so much interesting information in that book. My goodness. Oh.
It's interesting that you say that because I'm researching some of the sequels to it right now.
Yeah.
In part, and researching some other things too. But I got to be honest, Georgianne, I don't know how or where to begin this next cycle of books in that series because there's so much. There's just so much. And you can tell that the historical record, particularly the closer you get to modern times,
yeah,
is so doctored.
Oh, yeah.
It's so doctored.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, that's my complaint of the evening.
Yes, your complaint of the evening. Well, we share that complaint.
Yeah.
My gosh. You know, I had to go down and get some bricks and some 2x4 boards and have them cut in 4-foot lengths to put up another little bookcase in here.
Right.
Oh. And most of that bookcase is holding your books.
Well, I know you have a lot of, you have more books than I do. So
oh my gosh.
I know that you need bookshelves.
Oh.
I'm just glad you're okay after the events of yesterday, hon.
Yeah, that was so scary, Joseph.
I understand.
I grabbed onto the edge of the sink, and I slowly kind of, everything went away.
Yeah.
The sounds, the light, everything. And I landed up in front of the kitchen sink on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And Moshi was in the dining room, and he saw me. He's never seen me on the floor. And he came up, and he started, you know, pushing on me and brought me around.
Oh, good for him.
And I'm here.
Well, thank the Lord, hon.
And
someone's watching over for you.
It wasn't just the stove that's leaking. It is another big gas leak on the porch.
That's the part that I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I'm like you. I can't smell.
I can't smell it.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
Anyway, folks, thanks for putting up with my
yeah.
with my bad memory.
You're so precious, Joseph. You really are.
Well, my mom said other things, but anyway.
Well, we say that you're precious.
Uh-huh.
And
hopefully our next interview, we're doing another one this Thursday, right?
Yeah.
On Kennedy.
Yes.
Hopefully I'll be able to remember.
Yeah.
I'll try and read some books and get some sleep.
Yeah, get some rest. So everybody, work out Joseph's PayPal button on GizaDeathStar.com. And we love every one of you, and I thank those of you who are contributing to the Byte Show. Thank you so much. And Joseph thanks you for contributing to him, too.
Yes, I do. I want to thank everybody for the donations, and especially that gentleman and lady that you know who you are.
Yeah.
Everybody that's been making subscriptions to the website and coming to the vid chats with questions. And I really appreciate that. And everybody sending me articles, too. Oh, Georgianne, you should see the articles I get from people.
Oh, I can imagine.
It's really intriguing to me. I spend almost half of my morning period going through emails that people send me.
Yeah.
Of articles that they're noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to see how people see and what they see.
Yes.
It's really amazing, and I want to make sure and thank everybody for that, too.
Yeah, I get some interesting
I bet you do.
Articles from people, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I put a lot of them up on my data blog.
Yeah, I do, too.
I do, too.
I can't, you know, I wish I had the time and space to do all of them.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to see what people are tracking and what they watch and how they see things.
Well, everybody, just remember, get Vipers of Venice. You will be amazed at the information in that book.
Yeah, I am too. After hearing about it tonight.
Oh, Joseph.
Thanks for putting up with
Oh, bless your heart. Well, I'll just say good night, everybody, and I love you all.
Yeah, good night, everybody.
And tell them you love them.
And I love you all.
Yes. Yes. Well, they're worthy of love.
Yeah,
you know?
They are good people.
Yep, lots of good people out there. So good night, everybody, and God bless each and every one of you.
Amen to that.
Good night.